Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Bauert. Welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. I'm here with Fred. Hey, Fred, how's it going?
Hey, pretty good, Adam. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. And this is a continuation of a discussion that we were having regarding data collection and analysis. And we realized we had to stop the conversation because of time limit, not because of content to talk about. So this is our continuation of it. And it was interesting. We finished up with this question of how much can you, or how wise is it to fully automate data collection and separately fully automate analysis. Now, fully automate in the sense of what elements do you remove in the repetitive use of it, of the, you know, people, engineers making decisions in it. And we kind of seemed, I think, to have a feeling that we differed on to do it. My mind seemed to be more conservative of with great caution of removing decision points. And it sounded like you felt that there were some experiences you've had where it could be very highly automated.
Well, I don't think that I think there's two parts to the decision-making process. There's one of, well, it's not a decision. We're just trying to collect data. Say hour meters, like the odometer on your car, right? It's just collecting information. And every time I take my car in for a service or anytime the insurance company talks to me, anybody, they want to know how many miles are on it. And that is, you know, if I went to the same garage all the time, it would be a consistent record. Right now, it's going to like 10 different places and it's a mess. So from a, if I wanted to track the performance of my car versus its mileage, automating that collection of that odometer reading and say to a, my, that would drop it into a Google Doc for me every week or after every trip, that'd be great. I'd have the data, right? It's like a weather station. And it, not that long ago, people had to walk out and look at the thermometer, look at the rain gauge. Now you can buy systems, home kits, basically, that record and track all that stuff for you and give you plots by week, by hour, by day, you know, whatever you want. So that's what I mean by the automation part of it, is the act of collecting the data that is onerous or difficult to collect manually or otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, like the systems we've worked with, one of the first questions we have is, well, when was it turned on and when did it fail? Just basic time to failure data. If it has the ability to collect the date time of when it was first installed and the date time when it failed, we have those two pieces of data much more accurately than our shipping date and the call center date.
Oh, yeah. Right? Well, I totally agree with you on the automation of the raw data collection. The more automated that is, the more complete the data set's going to be and have more resolution, because you quickly come to the limitations of it being done manually. So I totally agree with that. It's the added levels of automation of processing the data after that. So in the case, even with your case with the mileage thing, in diagnosing an issue, that's, they usually also want to know, you know, time. Right. Mm-hmm. In addition, and then other factors that, you know, become to come into play. So I guess the question is, what do you define as data? Is it raw data, actual instrumentational measurements, or how processed is it? I guess is probably where our debate is.
Well, and I'm sure you're familiar with prognostic health management, right? For some failure mechanisms, right? If we're in a factory and we're monitoring, say, a motor, and if you just monitor the vibration of it, right? And get a baseline of what it is when it's running well and well-aligned and doing all the things it should do. It's going to have variation depending on the loads it sees, yet it's going to be in some consistent band. Now, as those motor wears or the alignment changes or the number of different factors that can go after it, one of its symptoms is going to be an increase in vibration, which may be imperceptible to you or me standing there. And so by instead of walking up once a month and checking the vibration level of it, is the many of the different instruments we're dealing with are getting so inexpensive, you could permanently put one on that motor. mm-hmm. and just track the vibration as a signal. It's like going to the doctor and getting your blood pressure checked. It just one blood pressure check per year or every couple of years is pretty rough information. It's not telling you the whole picture. My wife actually, she ended up getting a blood pressure cuff, a little home kit, and her doctor said, make a reading every day and at the same time, and it'll automatically upload it to her account. We could just upload it to her. And she said, I don't know whether you have a white coat syndrome for your blood pressure, that because you're in my office, your blood pressure is higher, or there's really something going on. So let's move the sensor home, and it's an automated collection of it.
Yeah.
And gave her a whole lot better information. We can do that with our equipment. I think where the decision point is that somebody's got to have to say, and I think there's an advantage to doing it where it says, here's a trigger that we need to pay attention to this or schedule a maintenance or whatever. think of process control, statistical process control. I have long been an advocate of doing it manually. We're making measurements. Somebody's plotting it on a control chart. It signals an out of control event has occurred, and then it immediately should trigger then the investigation of why did that happen. And it has to be on site. It has to be right there. It has to be somebody familiar with the system. As soon as you automate that, it goes to a computer someplace and a quality engineer looks at it once a week. And the chance of catching what actually happened diminishes dramatically. But keeping it on the floor, keeping it manually, has the advantage of triggering that incident collection piece of it. And so I'm with you that the human needs to be a part of this at some point. But in some cases, the human needs to be made aware that it's time to pay attention.
Well, that's actually interesting because that kind of we're talking about monitoring our monitoring system, right? Effectively, how well is our monitoring system working? So in the case of your automated, you know, statistical process control versus manual, it would be interesting to see how well your process control and your actual product performance is. And there would be need to have an alarm as to a certain threshold for mismatch for your process control to know you should have more manual involvement in the analysis. You know, effectively, monitoring your monitoring system so you're optimizing it as well. The same way you do in manufacturing with like HAZ testing and environmental stress screening.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've seen that in systems that they software programs that do the analysis and plotting for you. The better ones will put it right, like if it's measuring paste height and a solder deposition screening solder screening process onto a circuit board, and they use a device to measure the height of the solder paste at key locations and then plot it. What's the control chart heights? And it tracks that. And there's seven or so signals that something goes wrong. And so the computer is better at doing that than a human, of recognizing when there's, you know, three of the last four are in this certain band, or there's a certain sawtooth pattern above and below the mean and stuff. And that goes, you need 15 events for that to signal. And spotting that on a graph manually takes discipline. And computers are way better at doing that. And what these guys did is they put one of the red, green, yellow lights in an alarm system and wired it to the paste deposition machine so that if they got a signal that said, hey, this is out of control for any of the many reasons it can be, signals that it's out of control, it shut the machine down. It required an operator to come figure out what was going on.
Yep.
And as opposed to what I've seen done poorly is where they automate the data collection once a month or when a visitor's coming, they plot out new control charts and put it up on the screen in the visitor center.
Right.
No,
right.
That's not control charting.
That's called window dressing.
That's right. Yet a lot of our equipment now in all kinds of different realms have ability to collect temperature, hours on, types of activity, cars. At RAMS, we were talking to these guys that were gathering data from fleets of vehicles when they come in for routine maintenance or different coming into the service yard. They just would plug it in, download all the telemetrics from that equipment, and creating huge databases, which presented a whole different set of problems. But they were able to collect all kinds of stuff. And now they're putting, you know, GPS tracking systems on it so they know where they went, how fast they went, just way too much data. Mm-hmm. And I think that pushes it. I mean, it's great people are exploring that and trying to figure out what to do with it, because I'm quite sure they're going to come back and say, we also need X, Y, and Z bits of information in order to make sense of all this. And how are we going to collect
Yeah. I mean, you definitely don't want to get in the data overload. I mean, the trick there is to be good enough at it to pick out what you need and only use the rest if there's something specific you want to go after and you think it'll help. You definitely can paralyze the analysis if you're not, you know, not able to do that initial parsing of what you need. And I've seen that happen too.
Yeah. You know, the sensoring we're doing and stuff is, it is getting less and less expensive and less onerous to keep and collect that information. But it still costs money. It still takes space. It still consumes energy. And then if you are unable to make sense of the data afterwards, then why are you collecting it to start with? So I think that's where the reliability profession needs the focus, is what are the salient pieces that we really need to help make warranty accrual decisions or maintenance decisions? What's the right set of information thought out ahead of time, such that we are, at the end of the day, we're not wanting for critical bits of information, yet we don't have so much data that we can't spot a signal in it.
Right.
Yeah. So it's,
yeah. And it's going to be different for every case and every situation, which again is where the professional comes in, right? Deciding what's going to be the optimum flow for efficient and quick analysis, but not missing key factors that could change the results.
Yeah. You know, I don't think the problem is as much collecting the data as, I mean, and you were talking about it in our last show, is the data collected for customer service purposes and for return authorizations and field service type things is completely different purpose than for reliability. And that's an issue in and of itself. Yet if the design team put in a bunch of monitoring devices, if that's not thought through as to how we're going to use that data or what it could be used for, whether it's for signaling to the customer that there's something they need to take care of preventative-wise or maintenance-wise, or it gives us the vital set of clues in the last minutes before the crash kind mm-hmm. of thing so we can diagnose it better, that takes a lot of forethought. And I don't know that a lot of that's happening outside of a few isolated situations.
Yeah. Well, the whole incentive for the whole process itself has to be there. There has to be a sense and able to convince, because it's an investment. It's an investment in manpower. It's an investment in tools mm-hmm. and sensory and all kinds of stuff. And it takes to get people to be cautious, to be preventative like that, sometimes takes some really hard experiences. That's why a lot of, you know, companies have been able to handle, they say, okay, we're okay with the warranty costs we have, or, you know, they think their customers are okay with the failure rate they have. And it's not until that sideswipe happens, in a lot of cases, you can't react fast enough because these systems do not yield fruit immediately. You know, you start collecting mm-hmm. data in the field. It takes a while before you have enough that you can do anything with it. So that's why it's really interesting how often you don't see it. But then there's the brands that do it, and they do rise to the top and stay at the top if reliability is a key factor in that niche market.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. I saw a commercial years and years ago where this woman's in her kitchen and the back door, somebody knocks on the back door, and it's guy like the Maytag repair guy. I don't remember if it was Maytag or not. And he was a repairman. He's going, and she looks at him and goes, well, I didn't call for a service repair or anything. And she goes, no, your refrigerator did.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah. But I haven't seen that in home appliances yet. Yeah. It's not quite there yet.
Well, is that the case, or is it that the reliability has gone up so high in the design? I mean, how often do we really get appliances repaired in our home these days, right?
You need to listen to some of the episodes with Kirk. It's like every other device.
So, yeah. in his house?
Yeah. You've talked about a few things, too.
True. Not appliances, though. I don't think – well, I guess I'm kind of commenting on the change in what I call products changing to the appliance category from being a system. How much that's changed over the years, where reliability has become such a competing factor that, you know, customers aren't willing to really even tolerate it. I mean, you know, there used to be TV repair shops, vacuum repair shops, sewing machine repair shops. And I mean, nobody repairs a vacuum or a TV. You know, if it breaks, you throw it out and it's your chance to get a different brand or, a different model that you want.
Right.
I understand people still do stuff, get stuff repaired, but even dishwashers and stuff is pretty low frequency, I would say, at this point. Which I guess what I'm saying is there could be some incentive for some of those industries. They put all their chips in the designing a very highly reliable product and less in the service side. But I don't know.
Well, I'm thinking if my dishwasher could signal to me or to the repair center that, hey, there's contamination building up. There's a leak in the control panel, right?
Oh, yeah.
We're going to lose the circuit board. And you're going to lose this thing. It's a $100 board. You can repair it yourself in, you know, you should order it now. You snap it in, send us back the old one. Here's the seal. Here's how you put it in. And I could deal with that. And
yeah, that's
instead
true.
Of spending another $500 or $1,000 on a dishwasher with a motor and everything else is fine.
Or have it just show up. It gets ordered automatically. The box shows up at your house and you get an email saying, you know, we suggest that you do this. Actually, that it is true. I do have customers that do make appliances that are looking at, you know, making a Wi-Fi connection for just that kind of thing, for just that reason, where actually they have the sensory already in there. But instead of it just giving a warning light or a service light, it actually, you know, communicates, you know, with the customer and the factory to say, hey, you know, you should replace this. And then they try to make the system as modular as possible to where you can easily do it.
Right. Yeah. And, it does take the design for maintenance a whole different level. But you see it in medical diagnostics now, too, like different home kits are being connected. Like I know Apple, I don't know where they are with the whole system, but this health kit where you could have different diagnostics, you know, blood sampling, blood pressure and heart rate sampling, all this different telemetrics that the doctor could use to help do diagnostics work or track health. It's coming. And there's all kinds of different issues involved with the whole process. But I remember 15 years ago reading about a teapot in Japan that was Wi-Fi. And this was on the edge of Wi-Fi being broad. And why would they make a teapot? And it had a successful market introduction. It was used pretty regularly where children of elderly parents would buy these teapots and put it on their counter. And it would signal them anytime the pattern was broken. So if they make tea at 8 o'clock every morning and one day they don't make tea, well, it's probably, and you know, they're home or you suspect they're supposed to be home. It might be worth a visit or a call.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting.
Right. So it's not a intrusive. It's not something your parents have to, you know, somebody you care about has to consciously do, but you build it around the routines they already have.
Right.
And so that was the idea of the teapot.
Interesting.
Yeah. For me, it would have to be a coffee pot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. If you don't see the power surge here in Las Gatas every morning about 6:37, then you know I'm not awake.
Something's wrong. That's funny.
All right. So I think we're the collecting of data. I think we're in pretty good shape on. I think that it needs to be done with intention. It's not just collect all kinds of stuff. That's a waste of effort. It's do it deliberately. And like you're finding out and all of us have figured out, is that you can't look retrospectively and expect to get perfect data. That usually doesn't work very well. If you didn't think through what you needed to collect. But
it's like I said, it's an archaeological dig at that point. You know, the data may still be out there, but to get it is an ungodly effort. You know,
that's right.
And then is it worth it still?
So if we do automate it and we do collect it and we are getting good stuff, it can be a benefit to the customer and do preventative maintenance or reduced downtime, like home appliances. It can be used for diagnostics and supplementing and data collection for all kinds of studies and all kinds of different things. I think all the pieces are there. It just needs the reliability engineer to sit down with the design team and customer to say, here's what we need to be able to track, measure, and do to sense these different failure mechanisms.
Yeah.
That are important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, so really correctly documenting the difficulties that that you know you've experienced with what you wanted to do with the, like what did you want to do with this data that you couldn't do? And then carefully structuring your new program around that is probably a great way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't need big data analysts. We need people that know what to collect and what to do with it. Yeah. Yeah, interesting. So anyway, so much for our big debate there, Adam. We thought when we ended the last episode that we'd have a big row on this one, but I think we actually tended to agree a bit more.
We did. So we'll have to, I'm sure we'll find another topic we can have at it.
There you go. Well, let's ask our listeners, you know, are you finding that you're using more telemetry on your systems and are using it to basically phone home saying, hey, I need to service something or the customer gets spare parts automatically delivered to them? Anything like that going on? I'd love to hear a couple of those stories so we could round out this discussion with some success stories. And so head over to reliability.fm, and there you can find the Speaking of Reliability show and a handful of other podcasts that are available. And let us know what your thoughts are. Comment on the show notes, or let us know what you think of the show, or if you've got a specific question or story you'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear from you and possibly make it a part of an upcoming episode.
Great. Well, great. Fred, I'm glad we got a chance to go through this.
All right, good. Well, thanks, Adam. We'll talk to you later.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.